Very much. I was just a poor, lost high school boy from Howe High School on the Near East Side of Indianapolis who stumbled into Ben Rogge's economics class as a freshman, and that really opened up a world for me, a little bit of which I'd like to share with you tonight. I really think of this address, which concerns the pursuit of wisdom and the enrichment of human life. I hope it might shed some light on the relationship between those two as an opportunity to pay tribute to Ben Rogge. I'm not sure how much of what I'll say he would agree with, and I'm sure he'd call me to task to account for some of the assertions I'll make. But I want to think about three important people, Ben Rogge, Socrates, and Ted Williams. What about wisdom and enrichment? You know, we are bombarded with information at an ever-increasing rate, right? There's data, there's information, there's knowledge. T.S. Eliot in The Rock said, "Where is the knowledge we have lost in information? Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge?" Right? We are living, in a sense, under an avalanche of information. How do we distinguish between what's worth knowing and what can be dispensed with? And furthermore, on the topic of enrichment, does that mean money or power or fame? What sort of riches are we seeking? Does anybody know who John Shadd was? He was chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission for a number of years during the Reagan administration. He gave $20 million to Harvard Business School, the purpose of which was to teach ethics. He was very concerned by a financial scandal surrounding Ivan Boesky, whose commencement address at the University of California, Berkeley, was memorialized in the film Wall Street, that greed is good, greed is right, greed will save the USA. Shadd was concerned about that, gave Harvard $20 million to teach ethics. What do you suppose Harvard Business School teaches about ethics? If you're ethical, you will make more money. Right? That's true in a sense, isn't it? It is. If you don't have a reputation for quality, for value, for honesty, for customer service, your business is going to suffer, right? So in a sense, that statement is deeply true, but in another sense, I think it's deeply problematic. For one thing, circumstances may arise where cheating could be advantageous. Many of you know Plato's Republic, right? Whitehead said the history of Western philosophy was a series of footnotes to Plato. Glaucon in Book 2, Socrates, tell me why I should be good. Tell me why virtue is worthwhile, even if it's not accompanied by business rewards, right? Which would be better, to be rich, famous, and powerful, and a scoundrel, or to be poor, unknown, and persecuted, and a virtuous human being? Open question, an eternally open question. There's maybe a deeper sense in which the statement that if you have good ethics, you'll make more money, there's maybe an even deeper reason that's problematic. Because what's good for business isn't necessarily of itself good enough for a person or a community or for humanity. Now, why would I say such a thing? Because a human being is not merely a wage earner. And the human community can't be judged strictly by the standard of living. I'm not arguing for a second that business and prospering through business is in any way corrupt. But I am suggesting there may be dangers in idolizing it. The freedoms we enjoy to make possible business success are absolutely necessary. But if we get them out of order with other priorities in human life, they can be harmful. I mean, I want deeply to defend our economic liberties, but also recognize that economics alone cannot provide for a full human life. What, after all, is the end of business? Suppose our children, our grandchildren are going to follow us into business. What would be our hope for them? Well, on the one hand, we might hope that they would do handsomely for themselves as managers. We'd like them to earn a good rate of return for their shareholders. But maybe our aspirations extend beyond that. We want them to find a way to provide for themselves and for their families, but also to contribute something larger toward the enrichment of human life. Business is vital. We depend on it in so many ways, yet business alone may not be enough. Maybe it's not quite broad enough or deep enough or rich enough. This reminds me of a story. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. A man's brought to see his newborn son. He's standing over the crib. Some friends see him from across the room. The new father standing there with a look of astonishment on his face. One walks up and says, "What's that expression all about?" What does he answer? He says, "I can't believe it. How can they manufacture such a high quality crib for only $129.99? You get the point, right? I mean, there's a limit to how far business can take us. There's something problematic about greed, the desire for more. If you accept it's a vice, then it's inherently problematic. No matter how economically useful, a vice is harmful to a human being. What's problematic about it? Greed mistakes the lower for the higher, and the part for the whole. I consider myself a staunch defender of economic freedoms, but the greedy person is somebody who knows the value of everything but the worth of nothing. Economics is a vital discipline. We can't survive and flourish without it, but it can't be our ruling discipline. We were talking baseball at the table, right? The White Sox, the Cubs, the Dodgers even. I'm a bit of a scientist. I earn my living using multi-million dollar pieces of equipment to peer inside the living human body without cutting it open. I know a little bit about molecular biology and cellular physiology. Let me tell you, the scientists can explain baseball. Right? It's Cubbies versus White Sox. The scientist watching the game knows what's going on. And you know what's going on? In every player, every pitch, every catch, every hit, it involves proteins like troponin, and myosin, and tropomyosin. No calcium around, no muscle contraction. No muscle contraction, no baseball. Right? The scientist knows baseball so well, and yet the scientist doesn't understand baseball at all. Right? Why are they doing that? What's the objective? What distinguishes a great play from a serious blunder? The account of troponin and myosin gets us nowhere closer to the truth. Take the calcium out, the game is shut down. But that's not enough to understand what's going on in the baseball field. I think that might be true as well in the field of moral education. Money is vital. Economics, business are absolutely necessary ingredients, but they're not sufficient, at least not sufficient alone. We need a strong economy so we can reap the benefits of leisure and health and education, but a strong economy of itself isn't sufficient. I don't think it guarantees liberty, and I don't think it guarantees goodness. George Washington, James Buchanan, maybe you've read Washington's letter to the Hebrew congregation at Rhode Island, for example. Constitutional democracy is only possible if you have people committed to virtue. And the state cannot arrogate to itself the responsibility for cultivating virtue without fomenting tyranny. Economics, important but limited. Agency theory, important but limited. How? It's simply not true that if you get the incentives right, you can turn selfish people into the perfect family or the perfect community or the perfect society. We can't design a corporation or a community with only the most selfish and least generous people in mind. Self-interest is vital. It's the engine of our prosperity. But we don't want to be telling young people that greed is natural or that greed is good. What are we for, after all? What are your children for? What are your grandchildren for? It's not just to accumulate as much property as we can. Maybe it's not even quite to become as wise as we can. Perhaps, in a sense, our highest aspirations for them are to make as big a difference in the lives of others as they possibly can. Because our lives amount to more than just what we earn, and we are more than just what we do for a living. What kind of lives do we aspire to for our children? I'd like one of my kids to grow up and be CEO someday, right? What do I do? Do I have her read memos, quarterly reports, and stock quotations? Yeah, she's got to become proficient at that. I need to know something about business to run a hospital. But that's not enough. We want our children not merely to hold a job and earn a living, but to lead a life. And to be human, they also need to read Homer's epics and Plato's dialogues and Shakespeare's plays. Why? Because we become what we read about and talk about and dream about. And if we read and discuss and dream about economics, and only economics grounded in agency theory, we may become less rather than more. Mere utility functions and demand curves are not the ultimate ciphers of truth. What's life about? Try this on for size. Goes back to Plato and Aristotle and perhaps farther back than that. Our desires aren't just givens, right? The Freudian model of the human psyche, there are these desires, these impulses, these appetites boiling, roiling deep down in the psyche, and sometimes they bubble up to the surface, and our mission is to accommodate ourselves with them as well as we possibly can. If that were true, our mission is to satisfy our desires, right? And in fact, by expanding our desires, we can achieve even greater satisfactions, right? Fomenting desire, that's the way to go, because that demand curve just keeps on going, and as a matter of fact, you can never have enough. One model of the human psyche. Here's a different one. Our desires aren't given. They need to be educated. And by forming our desires appropriately, we can learn to wish for the good. When do we have enough of the lower things? When do we have enough of the lower things so that we can devote more of our attention to the higher things? The lower things, my job. I want to earn as much money as I can. The higher things, my calling to express the best that's in it, that's in us. There's a difference between making, Roger, you in effect alluded to this. Old saying, often misattributed to Winston Churchill, we make a living by what we get, but we make a life by what we give. And why would liberty be essential to that? Because human excellence, including the development and expression of the virtue of generosity, requires freedom. As Aristotle points out so beautifully in the Nicomachean Ethics, virtue, excellence, must be voluntary. It must be freely chosen. We need freedom of association, commerce, freedom of speech. They're absolutely vital. You cannot make people excellent by telling us what to do. But once freedom from is secured, nobody's telling me anymore what I have to do. I'm free of tyranny and coercion. Freedom from has been secured. This draws on a distinction I encountered first in the writings of Isaiah Berlin. Once freedom from is secured, what do we use our freedom for? Suppose we had complete freedom from, nobody impinging on my will, my capacity to freely chart my own course in life. What would I use it for? Well, certainly economic freedom promotes political freedom. Political freedom promotes responsible choice. And it's responsible choice that's absolutely necessary for excellence. Think about higher education. I work in a great institution of higher education with a long and proud tradition. What are we producing in higher education today? Well, wage earners, right? We're engaged in a kind of vocational training in the very lowest sense. I hope we're producing citizens, and I hope we're producing human beings, because our humanity is something that isn't simply given to us either. It's something we need to achieve. What are we producing? I say none of the above. We're not producing wage earners. We're not producing citizens. We're not producing human beings. Why is that? Because education is not a tool of production. And you can't produce citizens and human beings. You can educate citizens and human beings, but there's no way, it's a contradiction in terms, to produce such human beings on an industrial model. Why is education important? Well, it does augment our standard of living. But it does far more. It creates a sense of life. What's possible for us human beings? What's desirable for us? Plato's question, what is good? Are we naturally good? Well, this is the paradox of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. On the one hand, to be good is a fulfillment of our nature, but we're not naturally good. So says our greatest moral teacher, at least in the philosophical tradition, Aristotle. To become good, we require education. That doesn't mean indoctrination. It's not an immunization model that you can inoculate somebody, vaccinate somebody with an education. The word education from the Latin, educare, what does that mean? It means to draw out, to summon out. Education is something that's drawn out of us, right? Hence Plato's theory of recollection, right? In the dialogue, the Meno, knowledge is recollected, not implanted. The point being that it has to be inside us. A point, by the way, that Ben Rogge made on many occasions, as did Pierre Goodrich. So what's education? It's drawing out our very highest and best potential. What does that mean? Well, Michael Oakeshott, the university isn't a device that you could make tomorrow if only you had a sufficient quantity of money. Right? The university is not a lifeless repository of ideas. It's not just a certain number of chairs filled for the faculty or for the students. A university is above all, and this is Ben Rogge's classroom, a university is above all a conversation about what is a significant life and what do we need to do to lead one. Bottom line, laws can't make us good. I've spent a lot of time working on codes of ethics for organizations. Codes of ethics can't make us good. At best, they express our hope for how good we want to be. But as we said before, remember James Buchanan, remember George Washington, civil society is only possible where people are, to an important extent, already good. What does the Harvard Business School teach? Character is a means to wealth. Cultivate a good character, or at least the reputation of an admirable character, if you hope to be successful. Backwards. Character is not a tool to wealth. Wealth is a means of expressing our character. The Aristotle's Politics, why do we have private property? Well, one answer is because it unleashes the potential of self-interest to make us more innovative and productive than we could otherwise be. But there's another reason in the Nicomachean Ethics and Aristotle's Politics that we need private property. What's that? The reason we need private property is that without it, we have nothing to give. If I have nothing I can call my own, I have nothing I can share with anybody else. Right? I think about business in higher education today. Medical schools around. I get to visit a lot of medical schools around the country. We're increasingly run like, businesses whose product happens to be healthcare. Is there anything at stake in that? Does that make any difference? I think the danger in higher education today is not a lack of a certain kind of business sense, but rather a capture by business. We're increasingly inclined to evaluate our institutions by measuring their inputs and outputs economically. What's a first-rate education? It's one that generates the greatest delta in lifetime earnings, right? This is, I don't want to say for a second that courses in economics are not part of a first-class education. I count myself extraordinarily lucky to have been in the very last economics course that Ben Rogge taught before his untimely death. But let's face it, you can't really appraise a university by its number of students. You can't really measure a college president, a university provost, by the amount of funds they've raised or the size of the institution's endowment. If we do that, we're letting the tail wag the dog. I mean, on the one hand, it's comforting to think we can manipulate the faculty with money, right? Because then people of means can exert significant effect on the future course of American higher education. Beware, the remedy may be worse than the disease. Who was Willie Sutton? Willie Sutton. Bank robber, Mr. Sutton, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. This is the contemporary faculty, right? I'm a proud member of a faculty. Show me where the money is, and that's where I'll focus my scholarship and teaching, right? The professoriate is a kind of servile class, more committed to the pursuit of money than the pursuit of truth. Maybe a problem. What's education after all? Is a university, is a medical school, is a hospital a business whose product happens to be education or healthcare? Or in my case, is the profession of medicine a venerable human calling, the relief of suffering, the promotion of health that happens to need to operate according to sound business practices? Doesn't sound like much of a distinction, but maybe everything hinges on that. You know why? Because the best teaching isn't contractual, at least in my experience. Socrates famously refused to take any payment for his teaching. Why? He didn't see learners as customers, but as co-inquirers. I can tell you this, in my own life, the very best teaching that I've been privileged to be a part of, it seems less appropriate to charge the learner than to pay the learner. And to some degree, if we don't feel that way about our teaching, maybe we're barking up the wrong tree. You know, it's a gift, finally, It's giving the very best of ourselves and educating ourselves in the process. Gifts. Think about it. Many of the best things we have in life have been given to us. Our language, our culture, the care of our parents. Life itself is a kind of gift. Does that giving diminish us? Well, yeah, in a certain sense. You know, I pull out my wallet, hand $10 to the guy on the street, right? I'm $10 poor. But there may be giving that's not of that nature. Giving where life isn't a zero-sum game. Giving where the act of giving actually enriches the giver. Maybe that's the nature of wisdom. What diminishes us isn't the giving. What diminishes us is the failure to give. I mean, think of the institutions represented here. People who've given their best to these institutions, in some cases by writing checks, but in equally and perhaps more important respects, by other kinds of gifts. As long as we cling tightly to what we have, we're so attached to it that we're unable to part with any of it, perhaps we are not the masters, but the slaves of our own possessions. We are perhaps possessed by our possessions. What would it mean to be liberated from that? Maybe it's in the act of giving that we see what we really have. Maybe giving enables us to see for the first time what we have by giving us the chance to devote it to larger and higher purposes. What would it mean to say that in some sense we acquire so that we may give? And it's in our gifts above all that we express ourselves as individual human beings, as families, and as communities. By the way, I think you can give in your work. There's no barrier to generosity just because you're being monetarily compensated for something. I had a lot of professors at Wabash College, most terrific, maybe a few not so terrific. Compensation was equal. Those very best teachers were engaged in a kind of supererogation, right? Giving more than, strictly speaking, was owed. They weren't going to lose their job if they didn't do that. So what's the message on human enrichment if we think of wisdom in these terms? Perhaps it's that we human beings are perfected not through greed, although self-interest has a powerful and necessary role to play in the human economy, but we're perfected finally through generosity, because a seriously greedy person, a selfish person, is going to have great difficulty knowing the highest and best forms of friendship and love, what it means to really be someone's friends. Because giving helps us see purposes beyond ourselves. What's the relationship between the pursuit of wisdom and human enrichment? By the way, we're mercifully close to the close here. Ted Williams, right? Ben Rogge, Socrates, Ted Williams, 1941, end of the season, right? Red Sox at the Phillies, doubleheader. Ted Williams is on a 3-for-15 hitting streak, a serious slump for Ted Williams. What's his batting average going into this day? He's batting .399955. Manager Joe Cronin of the Red Sox says, Ted, you're on the bench these games. Why? Because if you don't go to the plate, you'll finish the season rounded up to a .400 hitter, right? That's not who Ted Williams was, right? Ted Williams missed three whole seasons between 1943 and 45, serving in the Second World War. And by the way, he missed most of the 1952 and 53 seasons serving in the Korean conflict, right? A pilot. What did Ted Williams do? He played both those games, right? He didn't listen to manager Joe Cronin and sit on the bench and finish the season rounded up to .400. Instead, Williams played in both games. In the first game, he went 4 for 5. In the second game, he went 2 for 3 and finished the season batting .406. What's this got to do with what we're talking about? Answer, Ted Williams wasn't about the numbers. As he approached the plate, he wasn't about the money. He was about using his talent, activating his potential to be the greatest hitter with the best swing of anybody who ever played the game of baseball. He is, not Roy Hobbs, Ted Williams, the best there ever was. He wasn't worried about the numbers. What does that tell us? When you've got the perfect swing, or you've got the potential to improve your own swing, when you've discovered what you're meant to do, and that's part of what education does for us, help us identify and understand what you're meant to do, you answer that calling. Right? The economics of it is a kind of byproduct of excellence at that level. It's not the reason, it's a byproduct. And I think this is vitally important. I think in a sense you could say Ted Williams was giving the best of himself as he approached the plate on those days. You see, there's wisdom. There's wisdom in what Ted Williams did. Because that's who Ted Williams was. That's what he was meant to be. And that's the sense in which the example of Ted Williams, a man who missed 5 seasons of professional baseball at great financial sacrifice, but doing so for some larger purpose he believed in, that's what he was expressing through his life as a baseball player and his life as a human being. And I think that's ultimately what we aspire to. Those are the choices of a wise human being who's in pursuit of something larger. And it's at that level of human endeavor that we're most likely to find real human enrichment. I've enjoyed the chance to talk with you a lot. I thank you very much for your attention. I hope some of the things, I'm sure I got some things wrong. I'm just not sure which ones they were. And I'll welcome the chance to chat with some of you, I hope, throughout the remainder of the meeting. It's a privilege to be with you, and thanks very much.